everyone, and welcome to Take Two Radio. I'm Pam, your host, and we are coast to coast today. I have with me today my buddy and co-host, David, and you're in New York. I'm in Chicago. Yep, and our guest is in California. So what, I think we covered all the bases, right?
I think we have it all covered, yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm in the middle, so here we are. Well, if anybody hasn't been paying attention, today our special guest is actor and author Matthew Arkin. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a beautiful day here. I got a couple of hours of tennis in this morning. Now I can hardly move.
Oh.
And I'm at a holiday weekend barbecue at a friend's house and taking some time out to chat with you.
Oh, hello, friends. Send me some barbecue, please.
Okey-doke.
Are you just getting back into tennis?
Yeah, you know, I played a lot in high school, and then I stopped when I went to college because I was too busy with all those college-y things.
Right.
And
right.
Then grad school, and then back in New York City where I was working and living until 3 years ago. And then I moved back out here to L.A. 3 years ago, and my older brother's been trying to get me out on the court, and I didn't want to get out on the court because I thought, I won't be able to play like I used to. And finally, about 2 months ago, he got me out on the court at the place where he plays. And
uh-huh.
then he said to me, he said, you know who gives lessons here? And I said, who? He said, Zach, who's the guy who was my coach when I was in high school.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
And so I'm back getting lessons from the same guy who taught me when I was in high school. It's amazing.
That's totally cool. You were meant to get back into tennis. That's all there was to it, I think.
Yeah, and I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you like to exercise and try to keep in shape. Everybody needs to do that, and some of us do and some of us don't.
Yeah, really the only other thing I do is cycle. I like to ride, road bike, not mountain bike. It's something I passed on to the character in my book. He's a cyclist as well.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, that'll work. The only thing is riding a bike is the seats. They're always so uncomfortable. How do you find one that you're comfortable with when you're riding?
You get used to it after a while. I think you develop
calluses. You get calluses. I kind of figured that.
Yeah.
I used to do all that stuff when I was younger and was able to, but now with some of my disabilities, I'm no longer able to do that. And I do miss it. You know, I do miss being out and about and getting fresh air and getting to do the things I used to do. But you just do things in a different way now. So, I'd like to start out with a little background for our listeners. Of course, growing up in a family that's in entertainment industry, I think it's safe to say it was in your blood, right?
Yeah, it was. I tried to escape it. I started working professionally as an actor when I was 8 in a short film that my father directed that was just with my older brother and I were in it. And then I worked through high school doing some film and television and theater, and then pretty much gave it up when I went away to college. I was the only one, I'm by no means the smartest member of my family, but I was the only one who had a real academic bent. I loved mm-hmm. school and was the academic in the family. So I went to college, and then I went to law school, and then I practiced law for 5 years. But I think once you've lived the gypsy life or the circus life of show business, it's hard to, as you say, get that out of your blood.
Right.
So after five
right.
years, I quit practicing law and came back to the theater.
Wow.
Yeah.
Full circle.
Yeah, and I haven't looked back.
Well, what was it that you wanted to, well, what's the question? What was it that made you want to go into acting? Is it just because your family was in it, or it really was something that you wanted to do?
it really was something I wanted to do. As I've gotten older, the things about it that are really important to me have evolved, or maybe they've just become more clear. I am a great believer, and I think have been, ever since I was a little kid, I've been a great believer in this. But of course, as we grow older, we're able to articulate these things and see these themes in our lives more. But I was always a reader and a believer in the power of story.
Mm-hmm.
to affect people, to inspire people, to change people, to change people's lives in a positive way. And the story and literature and myth certainly changed my life repeatedly in very positive ways. And as an actor, to be part of the process of communicating stories with meaning to other people, there's just, for me, nothing more rewarding.
Right, exactly. If you're going to do it in a positive way, because there's so much negativity in the world that we just don't need any more of that.
No, we certainly don't.
Well, at one point, your career has been all over television and film and theater, but one point that I wanted to talk about was, you were on All My Children as Dr. Norton. David and I are huge soap fans. We watch all the soaps. And I was wondering, what did you take away from being on a soap that you've used throughout the years?
Well, you know, I wasn't on for very long. I think Dr.
Right.
Norton had, I've played two doctors on All My Children. Was Dr. Norton the one who gave Janet Green her new face?
That's what we were trying to remember.
Okay.
I mean, it's been a while.
I remember.
Pardon
yeah.
me? Yeah, because then I played another doctor who was the ear doctor for Baby Spike.
Okay, because that's what David and I kind of touched on, was you had to do something with one of the kids, so I believe that's
one of
what
the kids.
It was. Yeah.
Right, when Baby Spike was in the car accident and lost
mm-hmm.
his hearing, I was the world famous audiologist who was brought in to take care of that. But about 10 years earlier, when Janet Green was a character who had been sent away to prison, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and then she got early release for participating in an experiment.
Yes.
A new experimental plastic surgery technique
right.
to give her a new face and turn her into a new actress.
Mm-hmm.
I was the doctor who performed the surgery on her.
Okay.
So I've played two different doctors on it. But I didn't spend enough time in soap opera to really learn that medium.
Mm-hmm.
I have good friends who've been in it for years and years. Michael Knight, who played Tad Martin, was a college buddy of mine. And has been a friend
him.
Of mine since then. He's great, a great
uh-huh.
fella, too. And, you know, that's a real skill to work on those shows and do a good job as he did. And it's not a skill that I spent enough time on the shows to really cultivate. I watch my work on the soap operas, and I think I'm... I will admit to having a very high opinion of myself. No, not really. But when I watch myself on the soap operas, I think I'm usually able to watch myself somewhat dispassionately and say, "Oh, that was good, and I did that okay. I could do that a little better." And you know,
mm-hmm.
I watch myself on the soap operas, and I'm horrified.
Really?
Because
oh.
Yeah, because it's a very particular medium.
Mm-hmm.
That has its own set of rules. And the same way that if you had been in that medium for 20 years and then suddenly tried to set foot on a Broadway stage,
right,
you'd be lost. But one of the things that I did take away is, you know, I played a doctor twice on All My Children. I played a doctor, God, I don't know, three or four times on Law and Order, on Medium, on Third Watch. Somebody asked me a few months ago, "What do you do on television?" And I said, "I play a doctor." And I said, "I have a recurring role as a doctor." And they said, on what show? I said, on all of them. And I'm about to shoot a week from Tuesday. I'm shooting for a day on the movie of Veronica Mars.
And oh, cool.
My character's name is Doctor.
You
well,
can't
I
escape
guess they
that,
like
can
to
you?
Play in that.
No. Just, sometime I'm going to have to buy my own stethoscope and lab coat.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think you pretty much have the terminology down pat by now, too.
Yeah.
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 Well, from all the time I spent with medical malpractice clients when I was practicing law.
Oh, that too. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's what you did as a lawyer.
Well, a little bit of that, but then that's the other thing I play all the time is attorneys. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you played that on Law and Order as well, I believe
I
it was.
I played an attorney on Law and Order, and then I had a recurring role as an attorney on 100 Center Street, and
Well,
yeah, a lot of lawyers.
At least you play the roles that have the big money in real life.
Right.
If you're successful.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to touch on your theater career. One of the plays that you did was The Sunshine Boys, and you played Jack Klugman's nephew, and Tony Randall, of course, was in that too. Two very amazing actors. What was it like to be in a play with them?
That was an extraordinary experience, to work with guys who'd been doing that kind of material, and specifically, you know, even though the Odd Couple that they did on television wasn't written by Neil Simon, those episodes, of course, the characters were created by Neil Simon, so they had an understanding of the rhythm of that kind of language and comedy that was just like going to school. It was amazing to get to learn from the two of them. And to see the energy and the passion that they still brought to their work was was really inspiring.
Yeah, they are two guys I grew up watching on The Odd Couple, and of course I don't know who didn't love that show, you know. So I'm just sorry I never got to see the play, because I think it would have been really an awesome play to see.
It was such a treat to do. And I remember one day we were in rehearsal, and we were just getting up on our feet to do stuff, and we were doing the scene where Jack was about to see Tony for the first time in 12 years or whatever, since they had their big fight and broken up. And he's putting his, I'm trying to get his jacket on, and then I came around to the front of him, and I started trying to straighten his tie, and Jack smacked my hands away.
Oh.
And when we got to the break, I went up to him and I said, "Jack, I'm so sorry. I realize I shouldn't have started, you know, futzing with your clothes without asking you first."
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me and said, he'd had his throat surgery already by this time. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you smacked my hand away." He says, "I was asking, for crying So that was a bit that then stayed in, you know.
Yeah.
And I would try and straighten his tie, and he would smack my hands away. But that was a really important lesson for me to learn, was that, you know, these guys who've been doing it for a long time, and I was glad to have learned that lesson with Jack, because a few years later I was actually working with my father, and I realized that, you know, these guys who've been doing it for a long time, when you're doing the work, they don't want you to tiptoe around them. They want you to hit the ball to them. They want you to bring your A game so that they have something to work against.
Right, right.
You know, so it's a really important thing to learn as a younger actor, that when you get those opportunities, certainly around the set and on the breaks, you want to be respectful. But then when you get up there on to do the work, it's like if you're playing tennis. I can't hit the ball back to you hard unless you're smacking it at me.
Mm-hmm.
And every player bringing their A game raises the level of the whole experience. And that's something I really learned from both of them, that they brought their A game every night.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, David,
oh,
I think
great.
You had a question.
Yeah. Which one of you or your brother has more, takes after your dad more in the ways of acting?
You're trying to get me in trouble? Let me see. I'm trying to think.
Know.
Do I give the diplomatic answer or do I give what I really think is the truth?
Well, you can tell. It's just between us.
Just between us.
I think my brother Adam is a terrific actor. I think he's an amazing actor. I think, so by saying this, I'm not saying I'm a better actor than him, but I think stylistically, I think my work is a little more like my dad's in the earlier part of his career.
Okay, diplomatic.
Okay. That works for me, I tell you. That works for me.
And I hope nobody...
Yeah.
Can we bleep that out of the final...
You didn't say anything bad.
You didn't say anything bad.
It's just different. That's all. You're different from your brother's acting. Right?
Yeah. I think
right.
there are a lot of similarities, too. It's funny because
mm-hmm.
I was playing tennis this morning with my coach, and I was playing doubles. We were playing doubles, and there was a woman who I had never played with. And my coach, he coaches a lot of people, and he introduces everybody by first name only. And we're taking a rest at one point, and Zach turns to this woman and says, "Tell him what you told me 5 minutes ago." And she said, "No, it's embarrassing." He said, "No, tell him. He'll think it's funny." And she turned to me and she said, "Okay, well, what I said to Zach was that I said, I'm not a casting director, but if I was, I would cast you as Adam Arkin's younger brother."
Oh, my
and,
God.
And I started laughing, and Zach
oh
started
my
laughing.
Lord.
And she said, "What's so funny?" And, and Zach was like, "He is Adam Arkin's younger brother." And she was like, "Really? Oh, my God." So, you know, there are incredible. And then one time I was having a conversation with somebody in Grand Central Station, standing in the middle of Grand Central Station talking to a friend, and a woman walked by, and she got about five paces past us and stopped and turned around and looked at me and came walking back, and she said, "Excuse me, are you an Arkin?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Are you Tony's brother?" That's my younger brother. I said, "Yeah."
Uh-huh.
She said, "I'm going to meet Tony for lunch right now." But
oh, my gosh.
She had never seen a photograph of me, and Tony and I don't look alike.
Mm-hmm.
We have different moms, so our
uh-huh.
coloring and everything is different. But she picked up the family connection just from the speech pattern. It was very bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you get that a lot walking down the street from people?
Not walking down the street, but when I was bartending and stuff like that, I'd be talking to people. And the time that I was bartending, Adam he was on television all the time. So his
mm-hmm.
voice was... And people would say, "God, you sound like that guy on Chicago Hope." Or it's like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you want another martini, leave me alone."
Oh, my gosh. So it could be a good and a bad thing all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what was your favorite play to play in?
Well, until 6 months ago, I would have said, hands down, Dinner with Friends, Donald Margulies play. It was a great, it's a great play. It was a great role for me. It sort of really put me on the map in New York. I got a Drama Desk nomination. The play won the Pulitzer Prize. It was very exciting. And it's still done all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then 6 months ago, I work a lot at a theater out here called South Coast Rep, which is one of the great regional theaters in the country, where plays like Dinner with Friends start. A lot
mm-hmm.
of playwrights, Richard Greenberg and Donald Margulies and some newer playwrights, they start their plays there and work on them there before they come to New York. And I'd done a couple of plays down there and had a pretty good relationship with them. And then last December, I'm sitting at home and I get an email from them, from the casting director down there, a wonderful woman named Joanne Deneau. She sends me this email and all it says is, "I think you should read this. I'm just saying." And attached to it is a script. And I read the script, and it's a play about a 600-pound man who teaches expository writing online who is dying of congestive heart failure.
Oh, wow.
And trying to heal his relationship with his daughter before he dies. And I read it in one sitting, and I called Joanne, and I said, well, the first thing I said was, I worry about typecasting, which she laughed at that, because I don't weigh 600 pounds.
No, right.
But then I said to her, I said, "You're going to do this like the Elephant Man, right? Just like sort of pretend." She said, "No, we're gonna do it. It will be with a suit." And
you'd have to be really strong to wear something like that.
Oh, it was an incredibly moving and beautiful play. And I said, "Well, when are the auditions?" And she said, "There won't be auditions." She said, "You just answered the question. If you want to do it badly enough that you were willing to audition for it, you have the role."
Oh,
that's
and
great.
It was from that moment, we went into rehearsal on February 11th, I think. But from that moment in December, it was like December 15th, I dropped everything else and did nothing but prepare for that role. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. It was harder than the bar exam. Because the emotional journey was the hardest I've ever had to do in a play. And then the physicality and then just the logistics of wearing the suit. And it was an hour and 45 minutes in the makeup chair before the show every night, getting into the prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also an incredibly moving play. And I never saw this because it took me 45 minutes to get out of everything when the show was over. But apparently there were many, many obese people. You know, the people who work in the theater said, "We are getting many, many obese people coming to the play repeatedly." And when we were talking earlier about the importance of storytelling, you know, here was an author, a playwright, who was courageous enough to write a character that when the curtain came up on this guy, almost universally the reaction of people in the audience was, "I don't want to see this. I don't want to have to spend the next 2 hours looking at this and having this experience." And then over the course of the next 2 hours, the play just relentlessly and gently beckoned the audience closer and closer and closer to see the human being trapped inside this physicality, so that at the end of the play, when the lights would go out at the end of the play, I've never experienced this, there was total silence for a while. And the
people
lights
were trying
come
to
up
catch
on the,
their breath, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there would be total silence except for the sounds of some people just sobbing. And then the lights would come up on the cast there for the curtain call, and the silence would continue. And then the applause would start. It was just a really courageous thing for this guy to write, and I was really proud to be a part of it.
Well, it sounds like it. Is this something that you're going to be traveling doing in other states, or is it going to stay in California?
It had been done in New York already, and then we did this production here. It's being done all over the country. I couldn't do it again. I would do it again if there was going to be a Broadway production or a big production here in Los Angeles or in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so physically demanding.
Oh, I can imagine. I physically and emotionally and mentally, everything. I mean, my gosh, with that guy. I can just picture this whole play in my mind, and I would be one of those people sobbing at the end, and mm-hmm. you know, and then of course giving the applause mm-hmm. that is justly deserved.
They just did it in Chicago,
and I'm sorry
ago,
I missed that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story.
No, cause because I grew up
he
on
dies,
plays,
but he does. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was going to say I grew up on plays, and I like to take my kids, and I would love to have taken them to see that.
Yeah, he dies at the end, but he is able to heal his relationship with his daughter mm-hmm. before that happens. So it's actually, as sad as it is, it's also very inspiring.
Right, right. Yeah, it makes people think about their lives, you know, and what they should do before they pass, because you just never know when that's going to happen. And you need to reach out to the people that you want to make amends with and, you know, go on from there.
Yeah.
Wow. So, well, thank you for doing that. I mean, that's just, I have no words.
Oh, well, it was a great privilege. It was a great privilege to get to play that part. So that's, to answer your question, those are my two favorite roles, those two experiences.
Yeah, and I can see why. Now, you are also an acting coach. How did you get involved with that?
I got involved in that quite by accident. I was meeting a friend for lunch who was studying at HB Studio in New York, which is where I had studied years before with the legendary acting teacher, Uta Hagen. And then I also studied there with Austin Pendleton, who you may know from Chicago Theater. He works at Steppenwolf quite a bit. He directs
Steppenwolf, yeah.
He's going to be directing Tribes this fall at Steppenwolf. And actually, the young woman who played my daughter in the play in The Whale is going to be in Tribes with Austin directing it, because she said, could you recommend me to Austin? I was like, of course I'll recommend you. You're fantastic. And I recommended her, and he hired her. So so you should go see that if you have a chance. But so I was meeting a friend for lunch, and I'm standing in the lobby at HB Studio waiting for my friend, and the director of the school comes walking through the lobby, and he recognized me, and he stopped, and he said, hey, what are you doing here? I said, I'm meeting a friend for lunch. He said, oh, would you like to teach here? I said, I hadn't thought of that. He said, well, think about it. I got in touch with him a week later, and I said, I would be interested in teaching. What do you want me to teach? He said, well, what do you want to teach? And I said, okay, well, let me think about that for a while. And I got back in touch a week later, and I said, I'd like to teach two things. So I'd like to teach just a regular scene study class, but then I'd also like to teach a very strict class in Hagen technique, just her exercises. That's all it will be. And he said, well, that would be interesting. We could try to offer that. He said, but that might be a little too dry for, you know, people, that if the class was just that. I said, I'd like to give it a try. And over the next few years of my teaching there, that was the class that always filled up.
Oh,
I mean, I had a good number of people
wow.
in my scene study class as well. But mm-hmm. the class in her technical exercises was always full, and it was very exciting. So then when I came out here to L.A., I started teaching privately as well. And then I also teach in the conservatory down at South Coast Rep, which is the theater near here that I work at a lot.
Mm, okay. Well, that's interesting.
And I love teaching.
You have a lot of interesting stories. What advice would you give someone just starting out in the business?
Study. And really learn what you're doing before you start worrying about getting an agent and a manager. So many people watch television and go to movies and they say, well, oh, they're walking and talking. I walk and talk.
Yeah.
And they come to L.A. and they take an 8-week class in on-camera audition technique. And yeah. then they start worrying about getting an agent. But the problem is, say you get an agent and then you get a job. If you don't know how to do it, you're never going to work for that producer or that director or that television
right.
show again.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be booking the second job. You don't want to be booking the first job. You want to get
right.
rehired. And too many people just think acting is easy, is walking and talking, and it's not. It's a real craft that takes a lot of study and a lot of work.
And a lot of different types of study. You know, as you mentioned, you teach two different types of classes. How important do you think improvisation, I always have a problem saying that, is, you know, acting classes?
Improvisation is an important skill. I would have to say that of everything, that is where I am the weakest. I haven't studied improv per se.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of improv in the course of regular acting classes where they say, well, let's improvise around this scene a little bit and see if we can figure some things out. But improv is a technique unto itself, as in Second City or Viola Spolin and all that stuff that my dad did back in the day with Paul Sills and those people. I didn't study that. I think partly because it was so much my dad's forte that I stayed away,
mm-hmm,
but also
mm-hmm.
because, as I said, I'm more the academic, so I'm always going to the text. And when I teach and I've assigned scenes to people and they come in and they're saying, well, I think it would be interesting if, I say, where is it in the text? It's not,
right.
It doesn't matter that you think it would be interesting. If you can't justify it in the text,
you can't justify it, period.
You can't justify it, yeah.
Right. Well, speaking of text, you are an author. And you wrote In the Country of the Blind. It's a suspense
yes.
novel and the first in a series of books to come. Now, did you always want to write?
You know, it didn't occur to me. I did a lot of writing in college, but mostly essays. And occasionally I would try my hand at a short story for something and I would get an A. But I never had the confidence to keep pursuing it. But I've been a passionate devourer of that genre, the suspense thriller genre, since I was about 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you know, pick up the first book in a series, and then, like when I discovered John D. MacDonald, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think the first one I read was The Girl in the Plain Brown Wrapper. And then it was suddenly like within a few weeks I'd plowed through the entire John D. MacDonald, Travis McGee canon. Same thing with people like John Sanford or Lawrence Block's Matthew Scudder series.
Mm-hmm.
I get hooked on a character. And then when I was reading the Matthew Scudder books, I saw that Lawrence Block had also written some books on writing. Spiders Spin Me a Web was, I think, the first book on writing of his that I read. And that planted the idea in my head, and I don't remember if it was planted the idea in my head or if my ex-wife said, why don't you try writing, you know, but somehow
mm-hmm.
the idea got stuck in my head to try my hand at it. And my mother is an author of some adult, but I mean YA and then smaller children's stuff, and
mm-hmm.
recently some adult stuff. And she always said, write what you know. That's what you should do, is write what, whenever you're writing, write what you know. Which is the same thing that you should do as an actor, act what you know. The character
right.
should come from inside you. So I spent a lot of time sort of playing around with who this character would be before I came up with the story. I really wanted the character to have a backstory that could sustain him. And give him also a reason for pursuing the life that he leads as an investigator. So I created a character somewhat based on me, in that, like me, he was the academic in his family, went to law school, sort of branched away from the family business, went to law school, practiced law, became disillusioned with it, and quit.
Mm-hmm.
In a moment of folly, as I did. The difference between Zach and me is that I quit because I had a passion also that I wanted to turn to. As disillusioned as I was with the law, I also had something that was calling me. He doesn't. He just got out of it because he'd had enough. and didn't like where his life was going. So at the beginning of the book, we find him about 2 years later, really kind of lost and not knowing what his life means, and all of his friends are looking, all of his friends from law school and his former life, when he sees them, are like, what the hell are you doing with your life? And he goes out on a first date with an incredibly attractive young woman, and they're having a nice time, even though she doesn't seem to be the brightest light in the sky. And he walks her home, and her roommate has been murdered. At the beginning of the book, the roommate's been murdered, and the cops are, you know, she's shattered and upset, and the cops, of course, are trying to question her right then, because you want to, you know, you've got that 48-hour window.
Right.
And they're going after her, not as a suspect, but they're, you know, they're trying to get information, and Zach is like, hey, you know, she's upset. Can you leave her, you know, give her some space? And the lead detective, who's kind of abrasive, basically turns to him, and he's like trying to get rid of him and says, you know, look, you know, this was your first date, you said? And Zach's like, yeah. He says, well, you're not getting laid tonight, so get out of here. Leave her alone, you know?
I had to laugh when I read that.
we've got a job to do. Mm-hmm. And so Zach says, well, is she a suspect? And the cop, just to get rid of him, you know, says, yeah, she's a suspect, okay? Go away. Mm-hmm. And Zach says, oh, well, if she's a suspect, then I'm her attorney, and
yeah,
I'll speak to her. So really, just to impress the girl, he gets in the middle of it. But then as he starts asking questions, his relationship with this girl, oh, I don't want to give too much away, but it's really the questions about this poor guy who was murdered, and he starts to see similarities between events in this victim's life and his life, so he gets caught up in trying to find some meaning behind these events. And then in solving the murder and in orchestrating his own brand of justice around it, he finds his new way in life.
Well, I'll tell you, as I was reading the first five chapters, excuse me, and by the way, thank you for putting those out there. You know,
yes,
I thought
you.
To myself, I wonder if Matthew acts out these words in his head while he's typing them out. Is that what authors do? Do you picture every single scene in your head before you write it down, just to make sure it works?
I don't know if other authors do. I certainly do, and then I read the dialogue out loud afterwards to make sure it's ringing true. But there were times, you know, I've heard other authors, I've heard my mother talk about, and I'm sure you have too, these people who say, I don't know, this character just showed up and started talking. And I would always say, yeah, right. Like, tell me you didn't plan that. That doesn't happen. That's like voodoo, spiritual, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I worked very hard plotting this book in many ways. But there was one part about halfway through where I got to a place, and I was working, and I suddenly realized, oh, my God, that won't work, because if he finds that out here, then he's got enough. And I sat at my computer. I was in Starbucks, which is where I like to work. I sat there for maybe an hour just thinking, I've created a problem for myself that I can't solve.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to solve this problem. Am I going to have to go replop this whole thing? And then I said, something said, just start writing. And I started writing, and a character came through the door. This guy I hadn't thought of before came through the door and started talking to Zach, and they get into an argument. And the solution to the problem came out of this guy's mouth. And I was like, oh. Okay,
now you know what
like
they were talking about.
That was like an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know. But I think that somehow, if you've been kicking these things around long enough, there's something in your subconscious that's trying to get out, and your job is to get out of the way
right.
and let it come out.
Well, I give you credit for being able to do that. There was times in my life that I sat down to try to write a book because I always felt that there was a book in me, but never got anywhere with it. And maybe I need to take some classes or something, but I have such high esteem for everybody that's an author because I'm an avid reader as well. And I just absolutely love that I can sit there and read these books and have these characters playing out in my head like a movie.
Right.
So, well, and you do that. You do that with your book. After the first
five
chapters, I'm totally hooked on it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, the hardest thing about that first one, that first book, Pam, is just believing that you can do it. I mean, I've only written the one. I'm at work on the second. But I'm not nearly as daunted by the second because I know that if I sit down and write 2 pages a day, at the end of the year, I'm going to have a book.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
or even a page and
sense.
A half. If you write a page and a half a day, mm-hmm. you're going to have a book.
Yeah.
And an old friend of mine used to say, when I'd say, I'm just worried it might not be any good, he said, so write a bad book.
Write a
but
bad
write
book. Get it out of your system and then learn from it, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it is daunting. It is daunting.
It is. I mean, I start it, and then that's it. I just leave it. And I think what part of it is I fight myself is, should I make this a story about a character just out of the blue, or should I write this about my life or something, you know, and that's what I go back and forth on. And it's not something that I think about every single day or every single year for that matter. It's just every few years this will pop in my head. So.
Right.
You know, maybe I should do that. Maybe I should just write a page or something every once in a while and see what happens at the end of the year.
Yeah, you'll have something.
Right. Now, did you put those 5 chapters out there to hook us? Is that what you did that for?
Yes. The book is completely done. It's been edited. It's had a lot of editorial input. It's been rewritten. But I put the first 5 chapters out there because I'm running this Kickstarter campaign to raise the money to self-publish it. And I felt like people in the Kickstarter campaign, you know, before they invest, you know, either a dollar or, you know, I've had a couple of people throw in $1,000. Most of them have been somewhere, you know, between $5 and $25, which is great, you know, because Kickstarter is all about getting to your goal. So, but I felt like before people do that, they're going to want to say, you know, can this guy write at all?
Right.
Is this a story that interests me? So those first 5 chapters are up there for people to read and say, hey, I think this is a story I want to read the rest of. And they, you know, most people are throwing down their $25 because for the $25, you get the signed first edition and the very, very exciting laminated signed bookmark.
Right.
that's the exciting thing, I think. But for $1,000, you get a character named after you in the next book. So.
Wow. That would be pretty neat.
Wow, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Actually, 4 people have kicked in at that level, but 2 of them don't want the character named after them. They just threw in. But 2 of them do. One friend of mine, she threw in $1,000, and she said, I'm sure you're going to make it a hooker. You're going to make me a hooker, aren't you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I also want people to know that there's a video that you did for Kickstarter about the book, and I couldn't tell you how much I laughed when I saw that video.
Me too.
It was so funny.
Did you?
Yes,
yeah.
It was hysterical.
Oh,
how did you come up with that
idea? Well, it's kind of a funny story. I agonized over the video. Everybody said, they say on the Kickstarter site, everybody said, you have to have a really good video, you know, a really good pitch. That's what hooks people. They said, most people aren't going to look at those 5 chapters, but if they like your video, they'll donate to the campaign. And I wrote a script, and I had my older brother film me, you know, sitting like Alistair, what's his name, from What was that show on PBS?
On PBS, yeah. I can't think of it.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
You know, great classics or whatever it was called. And I'm sitting there in a chair trying to look comfortable, talking about my book in an erudite way. And it was just horrible. It was stiff and boring. And then another friend of mine who's a PBS reporter said, well, why don't we do like a little interview in the studio, you know, a mock interview, and that can be the video. And I thought, that'll be okay. But I was agonizing over it. And then I was sitting at a friend's house one day. They were out running some errands, and I was waiting for them to get home. And I'm sitting there, and I'm agonizing over how can I make this interesting and funny. And then I said, how the hell with it. And I grabbed my iPhone, and I got into the closet in their house.
What?
And holding my iPhone, I did that in like 10 minutes, shooting myself with the iPhone. And then I sent it to I sent the pieces, because I did a bunch of different takes and everything.
Uh-huh.
I sent them to my younger brother, who's an actor and a filmmaker, and he edited it and put the special effects in and made it more, you know, jiggly and sort of, it's got sort of a Blair Witch quality to it.
Right.
It was just, you know, it's the kind of thing, it was like you can plan and plan and plan, but then it's that accidental moment of inspiration that ends up working.
Oh, my God.
It
really does.
Silly.
It's so funny. David and I both said the same thing. We were waiting for somebody to come out and grab you or something.
I know.
You're waiting for that jump moment when somebody grabs you.
I know it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I did have a question.
Thank you.
Matt, I did have a question, though,
sure.
While I was watching the video. I said, have you looked into guard dogs?
Yeah.
I should.
Yeah.
I should. Oh boy.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, it's worth it alone just to go on the Kickstarter page to see that video, and people would definitely donate, I think, just from that. But I really would like to advise our listeners to read those first five chapters, because it's something that you will not be able to wait until that book comes out, so you can read the whole book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And not only that, I mean, you have, you know, more books to come. David, I think you had a question about that.
Yes, you said this is going to be the first in a series?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
How many do you plan for the series?
It depends on how long I live.
No.
I would like to. The guys who I idolize are the people like John Sanford, where he, you know, there is a Prey novel that comes out pretty much every year. And after writing this first one, even though it took me longer than that, part of the reason it took me longer than that, as I said, was just that idea of, like, can I do this? So you'd put it down, you'd stop doing it. Now that I know I can do it, towards the end of that book, I got into a rhythm where I was writing for a period of time every day.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm able to do that, and know that once this book is out there, I'll be able to sit down and have the next one ready within a year.
Okay.
And I have the idea for the next book pretty well plotted out, the pitch. That's also on the Kickstarter page. The description of the story in the next book is out there. And it's actually a little darker. I would say that In the Country of the Blind gets darker as it goes, because it starts with this guy who's a little lost, and as he goes on this journey, it turns somewhat dark, but it also gives him a reason for being and a
mm-hmm.
purpose in life. And in the next book, we go further down that dark road, and he becomes more firm in his resolve to play this role in the world.
And he meets that hooker then, right?
He will meet that hooker, yes. Actually, the woman who gave me the money can't be that character in this book, because the sex trade worker in the next book, who is it's a woman. Her name is Ming Zha, and she is a worker in a massage parlor. And
okay.
You know, there's this horrible,
horrible underworld in New York and really throughout the country, where there are these basically modern day slave trade workers in this under the radar industry that have these terrible, difficult lives. And part of the story in the next book revolves around this young woman who's in that world, who somebody tried to rescue her from it.
Now, see, you already got me hooked on that one, too, so let's get it moving.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's been interesting to be doing research into that world. It's a very, very disturbing world of but there's so much money involved in it that it's very hard to stamp out anything that has that, like the drug trade. You know,
right.
How do you go after something where there's that much money to be made? People are always willing to take it on.
Right. And it's usually involving, you know, younger kids too, especially, you know, the sex slave industry, and that's something that should be stopped, but then again, how do you stop it? Like you said, it's all money, so it's very hard, but you just have to try to teach your children. Unfortunately, most of the kids come from different countries, though. Well, for our listeners, if you go to Kickstarter.com, you type in the country of the blind, and you'll get Matthew's page. If you just donate a dollar, you'll get an e-card thank you and a listing in the special acknowledgments webpage for the novel on Matthew's website. His website is MatthewArkin.com. One other question before I give out all your follow information, your social media and that, is how did you come up with the title of the book?
The title of the book comes from an old saying, in the country of the blind, the man with one eye is king. And it ties into the plot in two ways. One, that Zach doesn't know what's going on, but he's willing to look at things with his eyes wide open as other people aren't. You know, he's the one who's asking questions. And then the other way it ties into the plot would be a spoiler
I'm
not going to. But this idea of that the person who allows themselves to see more has more power than you do.
Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, for our listeners, follow Matthew on Twitter at Arkin Studio and Blind Country, which is for the book. And you can also go to his Facebook page, which would be facebook.com/ In the Country of the Blind. And then again, don't forget his website at MatthewArkin.com. Donate a dollar or more. I mean, I have 2,000 followers, a little over 2,000 followers on my personal Twitter alone. If you all gave a dollar, I mean, that adds up really quick. And if you think about it these days, when you do purchase a book, it's going to run you anywhere from $15 to $20 or $25 or so, because you pay for the book, you pay for the tax. If you have it shipped to you from Amazon or somewhere like that, you got to pay shipping. And in this case, you're going to receive a signed first edition paperback along with that, laminated cover art bookmark.
Yeah, and the $25, there's no tax put on top of that. You get the book. You're not paying shipping. It's you pay the $25 and it's all done.
Right, exactly. And then you also still get that e-card and the thank you e-card and acknowledgement on Matthew's website, because if you look at each of the perks, they, you know, as they go up in donation price, you get the one before, you get all the ones before it as far as a perk goes. And just to give you an idea, for $50 or more, you get all of the above. So anything that you get for the $25, the $10, or the $1 is included in that $50 donation, along with a signed promotional print.
Right.
And you'll learn about the series,
levels,
the rewards, and pardon?
There's book club at higher levels. There's book club visits. I'll come and visit your book club.
depending on where you live, or do it by Skype if you want me to. There's a mug, there's a T-shirt, all
yep.
kinds of exciting stuff.
What I also found interesting on there was the brew food book that you put up there.
That's a great book, great recipes if you're a chef. That was published by my best buddy from college, who actually just took the train up here from San Diego this morning. He's at this party with me, and he brought a whole bunch of different wonderful beers up from San Diego for us to try tonight. Because Zach, my main character, is, as you know, I don't know if you've gotten to that part. He's a
beer. He actually was having dinner with Cynthia and had her try a new beer or something.
Right. So this is my buddy who I started home brewing with years and years ago. That got incorporated into the book.
That's pretty neat how you can put things in there, you know, that you really did live through, and I can see how that would work besides making up other stuff. Please, listeners, just go ahead and check it out. I know once you get on Kickstarter and you read about the book and watch the video and read the first 5 chapters, you're going to donate so fast your head will spin. Is there any other way that they can contact you? Did I cover all the social media and the website?
Well, if anybody wants to write to me or ask any questions about anything, I can be contacted through my website. There's a link where they can email straight to me through my website.
Contact.
Just my name, MatthewArkin.com, and I would love to hear from people.
Yeah, and if you're interested too in having him as your acting coach. If you're a newbie getting off that bus in L.A., contact him.
And even not in L.A., I coach people by Skype. I have students all across the country who use me. Yeah, people who are getting ready for an audition, they contact me, and I'll go over the material with them and work with them on Skype.
Oh, so, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, Matthew, we want to thank you for joining us today. And it was a very, very interesting interview, and I hope you enjoyed yourself as well.
I did so much. Thank you both so much for having me.
Oh, you're
very
welcome.
Now go enjoy your party, and
okay.
I'll smell the barbecue from here.
Okay. Talk to you both again soon, I hope.
All right. Yes, definitely. You're welcome
Take
back anytime. Maybe once you start the other book, or, you know, if you do a Kickstarter for that or something, you know, or anything, just reach out to us. We'll be here for you.
Will do. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, I'm telling you, if people just look at that video.
Yeah, I know
I have to laugh every time I think about it, you know. It would be very interesting if he does do another Kickstarter to see what the next video would be like, you know.
Yeah, I know. Maybe he'll have that guard dog in him this
time. You're right. You never know. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. We really appreciate you tuning in. And, David, thank you, as always, for joining me as my co-host.
You're welcome.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Take Two Radio. Check out the website at take2radio.com. That's with the number 2. Follow David and my other co-host, who has not been on for a while. It's been mainly me and David, but that's okay, right?
That's all right. That's fine.
You could follow them at Take Two Radio Crew. Follow us on Blog Talk. They'll send you an email each and every time we schedule a guest, and you won't miss any episodes. Also, you can listen to any of the previous podcasts on iTunes or Stitcher. And Stitcher is a mobile app that you can download to your mobile devices, and those are both free to listen to. And then also, David has an announcement that he'd like to make. Go ahead, David.
Thank you. On July 20th, come people in the Syracuse, New York area. We are having a soap opera Saturday event featuring 2 General Hospital stars, Scott Reeves and Lisa LoCicero. Stephen Olivia. They will be making, we will be having it will be a dinner, what I have been told. It'll be nice little dinner at one, from 1 to 2, and then from that, you hang around Syracuse for the day, because at 7 o'clock, there's going to be a ball game, and Scott's thrown in the first pitch.
Confirm that?
Yeah, I have talked to Wendy.
Okay.
I've talked to Wendy about it, and she says it's going to be a dinner, and Scott is throwing out the first pitch of the game. That's for sure.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes.
That would be great.
And they're going to be doing autographs right alongside during the game.
Oh. Well, you don't want to miss that. Any of the General Hospital people that know Lisa Lo Cicero and Scott Reeves, of course, Scott Reeves was also on Days of Our Lives and Young and the Restless. Lisa was also on Loving, and I believe she was on The City as well.
Yes.
And
One Life to Live.
And One Life to Live, yeah. So if you're a big fan of theirs, I suggest that you, you know, take David up on his offer. And Wendy. How do they contact Wendy for tickets?
You can contact Wendy at this number, 1-315-474-7833.
Okay,
or
can
you
email
can email her.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can email her at Wendy at SyracuseChiefs.com. And Syracuse is spelled SyraCuse.
And you can also follow her on Twitter at Islands Forever, and it's with the
yes.
number 4.
Islands Forever, right.
Well, I hope a lot of people contact her, because I know that these events are slim to none these days. And as a matter of fact, I saw where Maurice Bernard is going to be doing some of these events, and his assistant tweeted out that it was going to be his last time doing one of these events. So you don't want that to happen and miss out. So I would suggest that if you really love them and you really want to see them, don't miss out if you're in the Syracuse area, and contact Wendy to get your tickets. And that's on July 20th.
July 20th.
And starts at what time?
It will. It starts at 1.
1.
It starts
1
at 1.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Everybody contact her either through Twitter, email, or the phone number. If you forget it, just ask David under Take Two Radio Crew or under his personal at Site Advocate. And with that, I'm going to say thanks, everybody, again for listening and joining us today. Go to our website, take2radio.com, for any of the upcoming guests. We don't have a lot scheduled for this month. I've been taking a break for the last couple of months. It's just when you do this on a consistent basis, 5 to 6 days a week, 4 to 5 days a week, since November, you kind of have to take a break.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing. But we do have more people in store to, you know, to be on the show. So just keep watching the Take Two Radio website, as well as follow us on Twitter at Take Two Radio and Take Two Radio Crew for any events coming up. And David, you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Everybody else, enjoy the rest of your day, and we will see you again soon.
Good afternoon, everybody. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.